Okay, welcome to all of you. I did want to tell you that Paul Fernall saw me a little while ago and said, "It looks like you're doing a little better." And I said, "Yes, I'm doing remarkably better." Considering that I'm exercising one time a day instead of three like I'm supposed to, you just can only imagine how much better I could be doing if I were doing all the things I was supposed to do. Some of you who are as undisciplined as I am and things like that, maybe you'll understand. We've been looking at lists, and the list that we're working on right now comes out of the book of John. For those of you who may not have been here for a couple of weeks, let me tell you where this is coming from. If you take a look at the 20th chapter of John, the last two verses of that chapter say there were many other signs or miracles that Jesus worked in the sight of the disciples, but they are not recorded in this book. These are recorded, that is, the ones that are recorded so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing this you may have life through his name. And so what we've done is to work our way through the book of John looking for the places where those signs are. When we do that, we find, at least by my count, seven of these, and we have worked our way through four and have come to the fifth one today. And the fifth one is in chapter 6. There's two of them that come right on the heels of each other in chapter 6. We saw the feeding of the at least 5,000 last week, and we're looking this week at the fifth one. Now, I told you last week that I was going to give you an assignment. Did everybody do that assignment? You didn't, okay. Because what happens is there are parallels for this one. John doesn't always have parallels to the other three Gospels. The other three have lots of parallels to each other. But this is a week where there's parallels in two of the other Gospels. And there is another story that is contrasted to this. It still involves the same kind of thing, but it's a very different kind of circumstance. And so I gave you those references, and I don't know if you looked those up, but we're going to try to go through some of that today anyway. Now, before I get too far started, I do want to do what Ralph asked us not to do, which is to comment on that nice-looking tie one more time. Ralph, did you see the article in, I believe it was yesterday's newspaper? It was an absolutely wonderful article in yesterday's newspaper. If you understand that I'm talking about Ralph's tie, you may connect it. Okay? I don't know who the gentleman is, but somebody walked into Eagleton High School with sacks full of ties, gave one to each young man, and taught him how to tie. And it was a very, very interesting article. Apparently, if I'm reading the article correctly, the young men wore the ties all day long and were saying things like, "I've never worn a tie before." So if you don't like the tie anymore, you could maybe donate it to that. But there was a really good picture. About half of the Metro page, I think, was a picture of two young men tying their ties. And those of us who have begun to get a little bit of a heart for good things at Huguenot High School, I thought, well, there's one more to celebrate. All right, back to this now. It's chapter 6 of John, verse 16. Okay. And for some reason, I'm looking at verse 22, no wonder. I've got two pairs of glasses these days, and neither one works at any distance that I need. That evening, the disciples went down to the shore of the sea and got into a boat to make for Capernaum on the other side of the sea. So wherever they were going to cross the lake. It was getting dark by now, and Jesus had still not rejoined them. You may remember that the last verse in the previous section, there were some people trying to make Jesus what I've heard some people refer to as a rice king. Feed us and we'll make you king. And so he went off into the hills alone. So that's what that seems to be talking about. Jesus has still not rejoined them. The wind was strong and the sea was getting rough. They had rowed 3 or 4 miles when they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming towards the boat. They were afraid, but he said, "It's me, don't be afraid." They were ready to take him into the boat, but immediately it reached the shore at the place they were making for. Now, that's one of the views that we have, and we've got two more to look at. Let's pause on this one just a minute. Why were they rowing? Okay. I love your answers. Okay. My bet would be that the wind is blowing the wrong way, or it was a boat that didn't have any sails on it at all. Take your choice. Okay.
Or the current.
Not much of a current in a lake, I don't think. I have found myself one time that I could remember very clearly on the Rappahannock River in a canoe. We were going with the current. We were not foolish enough to try to go against the current, but we were going with the current. But there was about a 20 to 25 mile an hour wind blowing in our faces, and the guy that I was with was my size, which meant that just our bodies in the canoe created enough of a sail effect that we were going backwards. You can row real hard in those circumstances just to hold your place. My picture is that something like that might be going. It doesn't say for sure that it was stormy, but my bet is it probably was. And I've rowed 3 or 4 miles with a current, and that tires you out. So, there's the first one. Let's go read the second one before we get too far into this. Matthew 14 is my notation of where the second one is. Matthew chapter 14, I think I've got the right spot, verse 22. The story of the feeding of the 5,000, or the at least 5,000, has just taken place in Matthew and the verses that precede this. So Matthew 14:22. At once he made the disciples get in the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After sending the crowds away, he went up into the hills by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, while the boat, by now some furlongs from land. I remember back when I was in college, my father, who was a teacher of science, remembered this one day. I suppose it could be an urban legend, when some young man in physics had such control over the subject, he'd been able to do some problem that called for a velocity answer. And in his boredom, he translated the velocity into furlongs per fortnight and turned that in as his answer, which required the professor to spend about an hour before they could find out whether it was right or not. I don't know what distance unit your translation uses, but my bet is it probably isn't furlongs. Stadia, yours says. That's the Roman distance, okay?
Considerable distance.
Yeah, a considerable distance. That's probably my translation. By now, a considerable distance from land was hard pressed by rough waves, for there was a headwind. So the thought of what might be going on the other translation seems to match this. In the fourth watch of the night, he came towards them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. The account in John doesn't include that little detail, but it's pretty believable. "It is a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But at once Jesus called to them, saying, "Courage, it is me. Don't be afraid." My English teacher would say he should have said, "It is I." Many of you are probably sitting there thinking that, so let's get that out of the way. "It was Peter who answered, 'Lord,' he said, 'if it is you, tell me to come to you across the water.' Jesus said, 'Come on.' So Peter got out of the boat and started walking towards Jesus across the water. But then, noticing the wind, he took fright and began to sink. 'Lord,' he cried, 'save me.' Jesus put out his hand at once and held him. 'You have so little faith,' he said. 'Why did you doubt?' And as they got into the boat, the wind dropped. The men in the boat bowed before him and said, 'Truly, you're the Son of God.'" The third parallel, the third of these three parallel sections, is in Mark chapter 6. Well, those were the contrasting ones. We're not getting to the contrasting ones yet. We're still getting to the parallel ones. Mark 6:45 is where it starts. Again, the story of the feeding of the at least 5,000 is just before this. Mark 6:45. "At once he made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side near Bethsaida. While he himself sent the crowd away, after saying goodbye to them, he went into the hills to pray. When the evening came, the boat was far out on the sea. They used far out on the sea rather than stadia or furlongs. And he was alone on the land. He could see that they were hard-pressed in their rowing. This is the first time you get a glimpse of Jesus' point of view. He could see that they were hard-pressed in their rowing, for the wind was against them. That means opposite direction they were going. And about the fourth watch of night, he came towards them walking on the sea. I like what this one does. He was going to just walk on by. Did you see that? He was going to pass them by, my translation said. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they had all seen him and were terrified. But at once he spoke to them, "Courage, it's me, don't be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind dropped. They were utterly and completely dumbfounded because they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. Their minds were closed. Now, when you put these three together, a number of interesting things emerge. So before I start telling you some of the things I saw, what do you see? John?
In this particular passage, it says that Jesus had intended to pass by, but then when they called out to him, then he came to them. So in other words, you need to call out to Jesus for him to come to you.
That's good. Chris?
The reason Peter did not walk on water is because he focused on the wind and he did not focus on Jesus. He saw the wind.
Yeah, let me adjust just this much. He could walk on the water as long as he was focused on Jesus, but when he took his attention off of that and started focused on that, there is both fact and metaphor in that. But that's something we're going to come back and deal with for just a minute. Yeah.
This part about is not understood about the loaves because they're hard to harden. Walking on water with the feeding of 5,000.
That's an interesting thing that Mark brought out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're putting it together now, what conclusion can you come to for what Mark was trying to say? Can you see? There were implications in that miracle. And those implications would have easily included what they saw. And they weren't able to make those conclusions. They weren't able to make those connections. And I think my translation says their minds were closed. Your translation said their hearts were hardened. Human nature sort of steps in. Yes?
They were followers of Jesus, and yet up until the walking on the water, they were doubtful. They didn't fully believe.
Yeah. Or they hadn't seen how far all of it went. They might have begun to see him as a special person, blessed of God, a prophet or something like that, but seeing God in him, in person,
right,
as we do, was not something they were seeing yet.
Do you think that the fact that he was walking on the water and they saw that, it implicated to them that he was outside of nature? Because nature, most of us would just think. But he was the Son of God.
And the previous day, most of them would have starved.
No, right. But he was able to overcome that nature. He was outside of nature that far.
How did they see him? My recollection is that when there's a storm in the middle of the night, it's sometimes dark.
Like a ghost.
So how did they see him?
Perhaps the slow is billowing?
Maybe. I have a more mundane explanation to offer. I figure they probably had a lantern on the boat, some kind of a light on the boat, shaking around someplace, and with the wind and the waves and whatever else, it would have, cast all kinds of shadows because you would have some kind of a frame for that light. I don't know that for sure, but my suspicion is they might have had something like that on the boat, and then, you see something. I don't know that you need to go.
And they didn't have a flashlight with that,
right? I don't think so. I will tell you that in all deference to the things that Travis talked about this morning, all of which were good, my own sense is that Christians are not so much called to be batteries that are recharged as much as they're called to be extension cords, plugged into God on the one hand and connected with where hurting need is forming a channel. Battery implies something operating with 10-minute extension cords. If you want an extra metaphor to lay alongside of all you've heard today, you still charge up an extension cord when you have the connection going.
Bill, I have a mundane question.
Yes.
What's comparable to the pork watch? What's time of night?
I don't know. Now, having said I don't know, I think the watches were 2 hours long. They might have been 3 hours long. If they were 3 hours long, then the fourth watch would have been the last watch, in which case maybe dawn was in the ending to break just a little bit. If it was 2 hours long, then night would have been... Remember, time was not fixed hours. It was 12 hours from sunup to sunrise. It was 12 hours from sunrise to sunup. And the fourth watch would have been the fourth of six. So the footnote implies the quarter, the 3 hours at a time. Okay, I didn't know that.
What's interesting is the way that they're, I know they're fishermen, the fishermen go out early, but it just seems like an odd time of night to be talking.
My suspicion is that they left near sunset, expecting to just take a short time to get across. And here they were in the middle of the night still rowing like crazy and not making much progress. That seems to be the implication of what I'm reading.
It's interesting that they just can go back and wait till
then. It's also interesting that Jesus chose that way of getting across. Why was that? I think of all the options that you can put forward, that's the one that seems to fit best with what I know about Jesus. I don't think Jesus would say, oh, it's late, I'll just take a shortcut, nobody will notice. That doesn't seem to fit with my understanding of how Jesus functions. Does it fit with yours? If it doesn't fit, then I think it's safe to set that aside. The second thing is, they're in trouble. They're going to need me. And I can help them wherever I am, but I can help their faith more if I'm somewhere close to. And, you know, walk on the water, I get there pretty quickly. I still like that little line that says his plan was just to walk on by. I don't know what to make of that.
They're being in trouble. Doesn't fit with his plan to walk on by.
Or else he walked by and make sure everything was more or less okay, and then he walked on by. Remember, in at least one, and I think this is the darkness part, there's one of those, he got on board, and immediately they were late. So they may have been closer than they thought. But I don't want to push any of that speculation too far, but I do think there is some value in at least thinking about what that moment would have felt like or looked like to the people who were there. Willie, you had your hand up.
The writer also made mention to the fact that he appeared to them as what they thought was a ghost, which would mean he was catering to their superstitions to try to get their attention.
Is there anything else he could have looked like?
Anything he wanted.
I mean, if you see an apparition, that is some barely seen thing in what maybe was the light of that, it's also possible there is some phosphorescence in some sea creatures. I don't know that there is any in that particular body of water or was at that time, but there is a little bit of light that comes from the phosphorescence of some of the sea creatures. Maybe there was just enough to cast a little light that way, but somehow or another, there was just enough light to see that there was a figure there. And if you apply human logic to that moment, as they would have, what could that be? Well, it certainly can't be a human being. It can't be anybody we know. It must be a ghost. That would be a logical conclusion to reach in the panic of the moment.
I could see him in the flag from a lightning strike.
That's good. That's good. Not bad. That might be. But however it was, what I think Scripture is reporting to you, this was where their conclusions leaped, was that whatever the evidence, even if they saw some evidence, it might really have been Jesus. Their minds were not yet prepared to understand that Jesus was capable of that kind of control over nature, the ability to work outside of nature's limitations.
I was thinking that Matthew was writing to more of a Jewish group, wasn't he?
Yes.
Okay. And perhaps he really was trying to say the Son of God, because that's, the Jews were expecting an entirely different kind of Messiah, and more of a materialistic, earthly one, and this was showing that this was a spiritual one, one God's Son. I wonder if that has any ties to it.
Might be. What do we learn from this about Jesus?
And in my opinion, you learn it almost as well in the contrasting passages that we're going to try to look at before this morning is over. What do we learn about Jesus, John?
I've got a notation right there where it said that when they climbed into the boat, the seas became calm, and that I have a notation that no storm is permanent. So that,
okay.
And if you, you know, you're going to go through storms, but if you're, focus is on Jesus, things are going to be much calmer.
Okay. Chris?
I try to remember when I have a storm in my life that the rainbow always follows the storm. It never comes to the
For what it's worth, I have seen one before, storm once. So, let me urge you to think about something else. How many of these disciples were fishermen? I think the proper answer would be most, because I don't know if you can quantify it any more than that. But more than half, I think. Right? People ever dive rowing across the lake in the middle of the night when a storm suddenly pops up? Think they knew that? You think the thought might have occurred to them, maybe this is going to happen to us? And the answer is, sometimes it does. God never promises that there's going to be a rainbow at the end of every storm. Sometimes terrible things happen, and they just happen. There can be a different kind of life after it, and we can maybe line that up with a rainbow, but every situation does not resolve to where that situation comes out good. Some situations come out terrible. And more than anything else, what I hear in this, and especially in the contrasting passages, is that Jesus is in control of the things that terrify us, and that Jesus is with us in the things that terrify us. I don't know that I can draw out of this the message that the things that terrify us will always be put aside and that everything in that situation will be good. Corrie Ten Boom was one of the people they talked about this morning. Well, she lived through their experience in World War II. Most of her family didn't. And lots of people did. But I just still think God was with her and with others during that time. Jesus is with us, in control of the things that terrify us, and joins us in the middle of the difficulties and hard times that life brings to us. And a lot of people in this room, I think, can testify to that. Bob, you had something to say.
No, I was back on the point of why was he going passing by? I mean, maybe he was expecting a response out of them, and he expected a response out of us to pass us by those other
difficulties. Well, I've got a different take on that. I waited a little while to see if you guys might bring it up.
Yeah, I am too. There's this wonderful moment in the book of Revelation when Jesus is talking about one particular church, and he says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." How does that go after that? If anyone hears my voice and invites me in, I'll come in. So one possible picture, please don't hear this as, oh, this is what it is, but one possible picture that has come to me is that Jesus says, I'm going to go close. If they want me, they'll invite me in. And that's what makes me really like Peter. Peter says, I still think you're a ghost because there's nothing I know of that could do that. But if you are the Lord, then tell me to come to you. And I like that because that's even beyond inviting Jesus in. It's saying, well, you know, I'm here in this trouble. You're standing over there. It looks like it's pretty peaceful where you are. Can I come to you? And that's when Jesus said, come on. And there aren't very many people who walked on the water, but it's more than one. he may not have made it very far, but he got out of the boat. And as Chris pointed out, when his attention pulled off of Jesus, back into the troubles and the hard times that he was in the middle of, then he started to sink again. But what happened at that moment? Don't miss this. What happened at that moment? Jesus took his hand. Jesus took his hand and lifted him back up. Now, yes, at that time the storm did go away. But the underlying message is Jesus is in control of the things that terrify us and joins us or maybe offers to join us, comes close enough to where all we have to do is invite him in. What's a messianic title? Keep your eye on the water. I believe the tune goes ta 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 ta. What's the messianic title? Oh, come on. Some of you are old enough, huh?
Master of the Sea. He's the master of the sea.
Billows his will obey.
I'm intrigued by that final comment. They didn't understand the miracle of bread because their hearts were hardened. And it's always been my assumption that in that boat were only the 12 disciples. But is it possible there are... The word disciple can mean the 12 or it can mean a whole lot of people. And, you know,
Which part puzzles you?
That their hearts were hardened. I said, whose heart was hardened?
Okay.
I'm curious about that.
In the Old Testament, the point of view that as I read it, I should be standing on my sign now, I think, is that everything that happens was attributed to God's action and God's control. Therefore, if people refused, then the phrase that was used was their heart was hardened.
Right.
Okay? Now, my translation says their minds were closed. Does that raise in you a different point of view about what was going on in their head?
I don't understand. If it's the 12 disciples, I can only think of one whose mind would be closed, that would be Judas. And I don't understand why. I just don't understand that. Who are we talking about? Who's heart for? Whose mind for the foot?
My picture is it's all 12 of them.
Okay. So there wasn't any.
This thing that had happened less than 24 hours before with the feeding of the thousands had implications that right now their minds had not been able to get around those things. They were not able yet to see the implications of who Jesus was. And the picture seems to be that somehow human nature or God's timing, I don't know. One point of view, when it says their hearts were hardened, seems to imply an outside agency was causing that. Their minds were closed seems to suggest this is part of their human nature, that they just haven't gotten far enough. Okay? Now, I remind you, why were there seven signs? John told you in chapter 20. Why is he picking out these seven? These seven are sufficient. So why weren't there five? The suggestion is five's not enough. And the suggestion is four is not enough. You need to see all of this. And it might not have been until the disciples saw all of this that they could finally get there. In fact, for the disciples, the eighth sign was the resurrection. And that seems to be what finally filled them with courage, took away all their doubts. Now they could face lions. Now they could face kings.
Maybe the type of thing as believers, we see something happen, it's a miracle. Somebody else would be sort of on the outside.
That maybe, although these guys were pretty close to the center and still struggled with this. Yes, Michael.
Bill, how do you reconcile this Peter, the guy out of the boat, with the Peter at the Passion, who denied Christ three times?
I got a sneaky feeling it's the same guy. And I mean that as clearly and as well as I can. Human nature is self-contradictory. And it's the same Peter who, at the highest spot in the middle of Matthew, says to Jesus, when Jesus says, "Who do people say I am?" Then he says, "Well, who do you say? Who do you say I am?" Peter's the one who said, "You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God." And he says, "God's revealed that to you, and that belief, that rock, I'm going to build a whole church on that." Right? And then he says, "I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be killed." And Peter says, "Lord, that must not happen to you." And Jesus says, "Okay, Satan gave you that one. If you can let me put it into vernacular. If I don't see that Peter is like me, with the contradictions and the coming and the going and the strength of this time and the weakness of that time, I don't think I understand what the gospel record is telling me." They didn't pick strong people. They picked normal people. And I can identify with all of that. I don't see it as contradictory as much as I see it as revealing the self-contradictions that are already there in all of us. Who else? Willie, I think you...
I was listening to the part where he stepped in into the water, which means he stepped in faith. But yet, the lesson to be learned was that he had to show them that they were not even close to being where they needed to be as far as what he required of them.
That's not a bad point. That's not a bad point. That there comes a point where you have to just put all of your faith, not some of your faith. And Peter wasn't at that point yet. He could still be distracted by the other things around him, as can we. As can we. John, can I go ahead and start the next part? I want to try to have time to talk about the contrast. What was the contrasting moment? The contrasting moment is they're all in a boat, and Jesus is in the boat with them, and a storm comes up. Matthew chapter 8 is the first place you see this. Luke chapter 8 is the second place you see it. Matthew chapter 8... My translation starts it in verse 23. If you found that spot and go back just a couple of verses, verse 18, when Jesus saw the crowd all around him, he gave orders to leave for the other side, and then something happens just before he leaves. Verse 23, then after dealing with this one last thing, he got into the boat followed by his disciples. And the implication in between the first and second verse that we're reading here, between 23 and 24, is that they had now gotten away from the shore. They were out into the lake. Suddenly a storm broke over the lake, so violent that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But Jesus was asleep. So they went to him and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are lost." And he said to them, "Why are you so frightened, you who have so little faith?" And then he stood up, rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. And they were astounded and said, "Whatever kind of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Luke chapter 8 has a parallel. Starts in verse 22. It happened one day he got into a boat with his disciples and said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side of the lake." So they set out. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. You don't get the detail that you got in the account in Matthew, but enough time has gone by, he's fallen asleep. When a squall of wind came down the lake, the boat started shipping water, and they found themselves in danger. So they went to rouse him, saying, "Master, Master, we are lost." Then he woke up and rebuked the wind and the rough water, and they subsided, and it was calm again. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" They were awestruck and astounded and said to one another, "Who can this be that gives orders even to wind and waves, and they obey him?" Now, I have a sense of what this would have looked like. And the sense I have is they get into the boat casts off, Jesus is someplace resting and falls asleep. And the rest of them are sailing the ship. The storm comes up, the ship is tossed about, it indicates waves were coming over the sides of the boat and swamping it. It indicates the boat was being tossed around and all this. They go to Jesus and rouse him. And I almost have a sense here of what it would have looked like. They roused Jesus. One translation says the order is this way. The other translation implies the order is reversed. That's what eyewitness accounts will do. But I think I sense a little bit better the other. They were trying to shout at him. Why were they shouting?
because the wind and the noise and the waves and all that were so loud, right? I have this picture of them shouting at Jesus, and Jesus saying, wait a second, hey, stop. Everything stopped. Then he looked at him and said, now, what was it you wanted? If you read that second section, it almost seems like that might have been what happened. They're shouting to him. All the noise is so loud. And so he says to all the wind and waves, just shut up a second, would you? Now, what do you want? Now, what would they want once Jesus had done that? They were awestruck, it says. Oh, I would be too. This one's a little different. Jesus is with them, but Jesus is asleep. They're not asleep. Not a one of them. Why not? Because the buffeting of the cares and hardships of life have got them so overwrought. So why is Jesus asleep? Does he not care? He's not worried. Do they have a right to be worried?
In their mind.
I believe so because I'm human. I can't do it. When I get a phone call from home and my mother starts with a certain tone of voice, anxiety leaps into my heart. And would in yours too. Why? It's not that I don't know the Lord loves me. I know the Lord loves me. It's not that I don't know He's with me. But I think we get more worried than He does. But I like the fact that when I call on Him, the first thing He says is, would you be quiet for a minute? I'm trying to listen to my child here. Now, what do you want? Let me remind you, all storms do not go away, leaving no consequences behind. Some storms come, and when they go, the consequences are there, and they're big, and your life is different. Scripture is not saying, trust in the Lord, and you'll never have a storm that causes you any problems. I don't think so. Another way to read this, Jesus is saying, time for them to drive the boat for a while. Now, they're capable of doing that. They're good fishermen. They know what they're doing.
And the unknown, if they knew what was going to be down the road, there wouldn't be, but they're not knowing, and so they're concerned.
And that is the predicament that time puts us into. We trust the future. We do not know the future. You can call it hope. You can call it faith. I call it trust, but I don't leave the other two behind. There is a strong message here. Jesus is in control of the things that terrify us and can, when He chooses, calm the seas. But when we're in the boat and the seas are rough and the storms and hardships of life are all around us, He is close by. And we can call Him. And when we see all seven of the signs, we'll see everything we need to know about Him. This is a good place to quit. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank You for the time that You give us. We thank You that You are in control of the things that terrify us. We thank You that You are with us and that we can call on You. We know that sometimes in this life, the storms will come, and when they pass, things will be different in their wake. But You're the same. We trust in Your love. We trust in Your grace. And we have learned that You're calling on us to do our part and that You stand behind us to strengthen us. We thank You for the love that You have for us, and we pray for this in Your Son's name. Amen.